Ghost Knight Media Studios and Paranormal Underground Magazine, welcome to Paranormal Underground Radio. It's time to explore the unexplained with your hosts, Rick Hale and Karen Frazier.
It is Thursday night, and if you can hear our voices, you are exactly where you need to be. She is Karen Frazier. I am Rick Hale. This is Paranormal Underground Radio and ZTalkRadio.com. Welcome. So, Karen, before we get started, there's just one thing I have to say that I always found was really funny about our introduction, the Ghost Knight Media Studios.
Well, we do. We have three studios. Yeah. We have yours, mine, and Cheryl's.
I know. It's like I kind of wonder. It's like, does people think that we like, you know, live within like close proximity and we actually go to a studio? I don't know. So
I do think that sometimes people think that because we have people that are like, oh, wait, you're not all in the same place. Yeah, no, we've never even met each other.
I know. Not yet, but we will.
That's right. Someday. Okay. Anyway, yes.
Yeah. How you doing this week?
It has been a crazy busy week for me. Okay. I am preparing for the Oregon Ghost Conference next weekend, the weekend of the 8th, 9th, and 10th in Oregon City. So I hope that people will come by and see everybody there. A lot of paranormal underground, dare I say luminaries, Cheryl, will be there. No, a lot of people who write for Paranormal Underground participate in this conference, and it's a really great conference. Yeah. So hope people come by.
I'm sad I can't go. I'm just butting in here because Chad and I really wanted to go this year. Unfortunately, we can't make it, but oh my gosh, I hear it's going to be awesome.
It's a really fun conference. Last year, the party was in my room and we got the people downstairs called us and that was the end of it. Yeah.
I'm going to ask Rob St. Helen all about that because, you know, he works nights too.
He wasn't actually at the party in my room. And, we had the haunted room last year and I have the haunted room again this year. So it's all good.
Cool.
Yeah, it'll be good. So I'll be selling some books and selling some jewelry and signing books and speaking, and it'll be good fun.
Right. Oh, you know, speaking of your book, Dancing with the Afterlife, I read it this week and
you read my paranormal memoir.
I did.
I'm crazy.
Loved it. Of course. I don't think you're insane. I mean, look at the last 31 years of my life. You think I would think that you're crazy?
No. Well, maybe.
Please. No.
I'm glad you liked it. It was written from the heart.
Yeah, and you could tell that too. It really comes across that way. You know, like in the first couple chapters with, you know, like your superhero origin story and all. I don't ever remember hearing the story about the blow up Godzilla. When you were living in San Francisco with your husband?
My first husband. Actually, no, it was in Bremerton. Yeah, it was in Bremerton, Washington.
Wait a minute. Oh, my God. I'm so sorry. I feel like such an idiot. Why was I thinking San Francisco?
Military, probably, or something.
Military.
Who knows?
Yeah. Well, I thought Navy. It's like San Francisco. Anyways, but I did read the book, and, you know, your superhero origin story of how you first got interested in all of this is really, really good. And I had one of those blow-up Godzilla dolls. I had one.
Oh, yeah. See, there you go. It's yes, but like I say, so here's the difference between your blow-up Godzilla doll and mine. You never walked into your apartment when nobody had been there and found it sitting in the middle of your bed staring malevolently at you, I would guess.
No, I've never actually had that. I mean, you know, every now and then I will come into my basement and I found some weird stuff. Like I'm on the treadmill the other night and I just get off and I didn't say anything. And in my ear, I hear a man say, no. I mean, it was like, what the heck is going on here? But I mean, it's just Paul.
Keep working, dude.
Yeah, it's just Paul. He likes to watch as I work out. It's a ghost, it's a weird spirit. Yeah, I know you hear me, Paul. So anyway.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Paul. So with that being said, this week we have a great show. We have a double bill for everybody to listen to tonight. First hour, we're going to be talking to Dina Ray. She is a fiction author. She is the author of Halo of the Damned and Bad Juju, which I said are both fiction novels. We're also going to be talking about conspiracy theories. I love conspiracy theories only because they're so incredibly improbable. What do you think about conspiracy theories?
Well, you know, I was actually going to do my top 10 list for March on conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. And I changed it because I couldn't make conspiracy theories any funnier than they already were.
Yeah.
I mean, and conspiracy theories by their nature aren't funny, most of them, but they are entertaining in other ways. The fact, you know, I believe conspiracies exist.
Sure, of course.
That being said, I think there are some seriously whacked out conspiracy theories out there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, my favorite conspiracy theory over the last 15 years have been the whole, you know, the gays are coming to get your kids, you know, to, like, indoctrinate them. And yeah. It's like, you know, I got a lot of gay friends. My older brother's gay, and, you know, he actually said one time, he's like, "Now we're not interested in kids because we can't get them into clubs." And it's yeah, it was the most hilarious thing I've ever heard. But, yeah, I definitely think that is my favorite conspiracy theory.
Yeah, I still think that mine is the whole man never walked on the moon.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, why? For what purpose would someone construct such an elaborate hoax?
Well, I think that somebody would construct such an elaborate hoax is because it was, let's face it, it was at a time where the United States really needed to kick it into high gear. The Russians had already been into space for, like, I think 15 years or whatever already. It was time for us to kick it into high gear. And, you know, if you know, just like the United States of America, if you're going to go big, we're going to go big. So, and I think that was what the problem is. People think that it was a lie just so we could, you know, try and win the space race as well as the Cold War. And obviously at the time that didn't happen. So, well, I do believe they were there.
And, you know, my husband's uncle was an astronaut. He was the commander of the Challenger.
Yeah.
Dick Scobee. And, you know, they go into space. It happens.
Oh, I have no doubt about that. So. I mean, you know, you can look up and you could see satellites and stuff. I remember there was one time where you could actually, if you had a, I think it was the last time that the space shuttle went up. If you had a powerful enough telescope, you could see the space shuttle. And it's like, I have friends that are like, yeah, you can see the space shuttle up there. They're really up there. We're really out in space. So, yeah.
How jacked would you be if you were in space? I mean, could you imagine?
I'd be terrified.
I'd be excited. I mean, even though, you know, Uncle Dick met a rather bad fate, but that was before he even got into space. You know, I think I'd be kicking myself, pinching myself the whole time. I'm in space. Oh my God, I'm in space. It's like the first time you're having sex. I can't believe I'm doing this.
Yeah, I remember that reaction well. Or no, actually, it's more like, I can't believe somebody's having sex with me.
Right, exactly. That's true.
But no, to go out in outer space, I would be completely terrified because, first off, I'm claustrophobic, don't like tight spaces. And just the idea of at any moment an alien ship could come along and blast me into oblivion, you know, just doesn't excite me. So.
Oh, see, I think it would be really cool. And the other thing is that I think if I were in space and traveling in space, I would keep my eyes peeled for alien ships, because, you know, even like pilots, if you hear pilots tell stories, they have stories to tell of things that they've seen.
Yeah. And I think that one of the most amazing stories I've ever heard was the one that happened in Iran back, I think it was in the early 80s. I mean, these guys, their pilots were literally attacked by these UFOs. And they're like, yeah, this was something that was very real. And you know, I mean, hey, I have no reason not to believe the Iranians, so whatever. But, you know, I say that tongue-in-cheek, of course. But, you know, I think that that's an amazing story. And basically, even recently, Russia has said to President Obama, it's like, hey, you know, you better tell the rest of the world about the UFOs, because if you don't, we will. So, I mean, that's kind of like a weird ultimatum.
Yes. Well, you know, we had a good conversation a couple weeks ago with Stanton Friedman. Have you recovered from that, by the way? You know, I know you were pretty excited.
I have. Well, it's like I said, I'm such a fanboy, and, you know, he's such a respected researcher in the field that it's like, how could you not be? But, you know,
Yeah, well, I'm really excited because in our second hour, we are going to be talking time travel.
Yes.
And I know so very little about it, but it just excites me.
And that's going to be with Andrew Basiago. He's a team leader of the Pegasus Project. And we're going to be talking about his days as a child time traveler. But I do have questions because there are some things that are very strange that I've seen in pictures. Of course, you got the Charlie Chaplin, the circus video. You were just watching that right before the show. You got the guy, or the 1941 bridge being built in Canada. You could see this guy standing there, and it's like he looks like some hipster dude that lives down the street from me. He looks like a modern man, and his clothes look very modern as well.
Fashions go around. Fashions are cyclical. You know, my kid wears skinny jeans. Well, you know, the last time I saw skinny jeans was when I was the 80s, when I was, you know, younger. Yeah. So fashions do go around. They you know, everybody thinks that what they're doing is brand new, but there's some of that falls within logical. Although the Charlie Chaplin video that you had me watch with the cell phone, wow. So Cheryl just actually feels that you and I are talking too much because she just sent a
little.
Are
they playing the music to play us off?
She just sent. Yeah, they're going to do like they did at the Academy Awards with the Jaws theme when anybody was talking too much. That wasn't rude or anything.
Stevie Wonder, get off the stage.
That's right. She just Skyped me and told me that we need to take a break. We're 1 minute past our break because we were so enthralled with the sounds of our own voices.
Yes, I do love the sound of my own voice.
I know you do. All right, so stick around, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes. This is Paranormal Underground Radio on Z-Talk Radio. We will be right back.
Hi, this is Karen Frazier, author of Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington, a new book from Ghost Night Media. In summer of 2009, I visited Wellington, Washington, a former railroad town in the Cascade Mountains of Washington State, where the worst avalanche disaster in the history of the United States occurred. 96 people lost their lives. What I found there changed my life forever. Before I visited Wellington, I wasn't sure that I believed in ghosts or even in the human soul. Now I know for sure that ghosts are real and that our souls go on after we die. You can read all about my experiences at Wellington in my new book, Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington, which is on sale at Amazon.com. To learn more, visit avalancheofspirits.com.
Hi, I'm Chad Wilson, publisher and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
And I'm Cheryl Knight, editor-in-chief and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
Every month, Paranormal Underground explores the unexplained with a free monthly online magazine.
We take an in-depth look at all kinds of unexplained phenomena, talk with some of the field's top experts, and share the latest news and information about the paranormal.
Visit us at ParanormalUnderground.net, where you can read the magazine online, explore our paranormal evidence galleries, watch videos, participate in discussions, or read blogs with some of our writers and editors.
We hope you'll join us. Visit ParanormalUnderground.net and explore the unexplained.
Do you want to keep up with what's going on at Paranormal Underground?
Then tweet us on Twitter at ParanormalUG.
Or follow us on Facebook at Paranormal Underground.
Meet us on MySpace, Paranormal Underground.
There's no need to be in the dark about what's going on at Paranormal Underground. Join us on your favorite social networking site today.
Hi everyone, it's Karen Frazier at Paranormal Underground.
And I'm Rick Hale, Paranormal Underground writer.
We're here to invite you to explore the unexplained with Paranormal Underground Radio, live and on the air.
Join us every Thursday night for paranormal talk and great guests from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time on ztalkradio.com.
There's something in your mind you cannot hide. You can't
try, you can try everything. You'll be high in the end. But there's something on your cheek that's blowing like a creek. Are there tears, or just dying memories? Keep doing what you do, remember that anyway. You are the stolen thief. Keep seeing what you say, but remember that everywhere. My friend, maybe you think the people would fall into your traps, but look better around you. There's nothing but your life. You're lost in your mind without no compass. You can try to pinch yourself and wake up fast. Keep doing what you do, but remember that anyway. You are the stolen thief. Keep saying what you say, but remember that everywhere. The stolen thief. You'll be the stolen thief. You'll be the stolen thief. You'll be the stolen thief, my friend. Keep doing what you do, but remember that anyway. You are the stolen thief. Keep saying what you say, but remember that anyway. You'll be the stolen thief. You'll be the stolen thief. You'll be the stolen thief. You'll be the stolen thief, my friend.
Station identification.
You're listening to ZTalk Radio Network.
Operating frequency
on ztalkradio.com. The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of ZTalk Radio, its affiliates, or sponsors.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Paranormal Underground Radio at ztalkradio.com. We are your hosts, Karen and Rick. Tonight, joining us for our first hour is going to be author Dina Ray. She is the author of such fiction novels as Halo of the Damned, as well as Bad Juju. And we are going to be talking about conspiracy theories as well. And she's a fellow Chicagoan. So, Dina Ray, go Bears.
Hey, hi, how are you? Thanks for having me. Go Bears. I don't know about the Bears anymore, but
I know.
Go Hawks.
Go Hawks, there you go.
I have nothing to say after that. I'm sorry. I am not in Chicago.
No, she's about as far away from us as you could possibly get, Dina. So she's
now where are you from?
I'm in southwestern Washington.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but that's where our next guest tonight is from. So, you know, I can say Go Hawks or something when a little later.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
So, you are a novelist, and you tell us about the types of topics that your novels are about, Dina.
Well, they are fiction, but I do want to stress that I put a lot of time and research into all of my work because I'm the kind of reader that likes to read books and learn something.
Yes.
So, sure, and I just figured that's the kind of writer that I you know, aspire to be. I get upset if I read a book and I really haven't learned anything. So I do put all kinds of facts and stuff in there. If you're reading my book, about a 95% chance that I did not completely make this up. It is a tidbit from, you know, something I found in a real life book or video or whatever.
You know, that's something I always wonder, because I do read quite a lot of fiction. As a matter of fact, I'm reading right now The Aviator's Wife, which is a fictionalized version of Charles Lindbergh's marriage. And I always, when I read books like that, or just any novel, I always wonder how much is actual fact. And I appreciate the authors like you who do that extensive research so that there's an authenticity to the book that you don't get with somebody who's just pretty much making stuff up.
Yeah, I think we've grown as a society. We're a little bit more sophisticated than that now. You know,
well, some of us.
Comic books. I only read comic books. So. No, I'm totally joking.
No, I'm into the graphic novel. That's all he reads.
seriously, though, I'm not really much of a fiction reader. I like, you know, a lot of nonfiction. I'm really into history and of course, you know, researching all, you know, aspects of the paranormal. But that's something with like what your books do touch on. Let's. I was reading up a little bit on your books, and Halo of the Damned is definitely one of the more, I thought really puts a lot of supernatural beings and biblical type stuff in it. Let's talk a little bit about Halo of the Damned. This guy, he's a media person, right?
I'm sorry, he's a what kind of person?
What person?
I thought he was in the media. Is he?
Oh, media. Right. Oh, okay, media. You're right. You're absolutely right. My main character is a fallen angel who runs an advertising empire.
Advertising, thank you.
Now, wait, I have to ask you, because that is just a really odd combination. How did you come up with that?
Well, I am... I'm a conspiracy theorist, of course, self-appointed expert in conspiracy.
Excellent.
And I find the advertising world a fascinating, I'm looking for the right word here, a fascinating corporate way of mind controlling people.
Absolutely. I have to tell you that my background is in advertising.
So you're part of it, Karen.
I absolutely agree with what you're saying. There are ways, and I don't do advertising any longer except for marketing like my own stuff and, you know, a little bit of really small scale stuff. But you're absolutely right in what you're saying. I mean, what a perfect place to launch conspiracies, and probably the birthplace of like a gazillion of the conspiracies that are actually taking place in our world. Because if you control the press and you control advertising, what more do you need, right?
Yeah.
I never worked in advertising, but in college I took a couple of courses in marketing and journalism, and they just, you know how most of what you learn kind of goes out of your brain and you move on. And when they were talking about subliminal advertising and you know, the early stages of the To Kiss Disco, but I might be mispronouncing it, but that's when they're like flashing images at you and you don't know it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's all true. It all happens. It's in our advertising now. People don't realize how much they're being controlled. They're being controlled in two ways. One is in the advertising, and the other way is in the products themselves, because the people who create products, whether it's food products or, you know, things that you smoke or things that you wear, they come up with a way to make you feel you need this. They find out what you most need. They meet that need, and then their advertising people convince you that you need it. So
like that famous Absolute Vodka magazine ad, they arranged the ice in the glass that spelled out sex.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really obvious that it says that. I mean, I've looked at that picture 1,000 times, and yeah, it says sex. It's pretty obvious.
Well, if you can go through, if you go through print advertising and really analyze print advertising, almost every piece of print advertising has something phallic in it. It's mind control.
Yeah. As sex and buy me and all the little things that they do to, you know, make you think that you actually need this product, and it'll make you better looking and make you look more intelligent and make you look like you're on the track to wealth. And it's amazing.
Well, why do you think we're so addicted in our country and in Western society, really, to this consumer culture? And why do you think, even in the midst of this huge economic collapse that we're still in the middle of, regardless of what anybody tells you, that people still buy a bunch of crap they don't need?
I don't get it. I have friends who, you know, have been really hit hard by this recession to the point, you know, where if they miss one more payment, who knows what will happen with their house and whatever. And, you know, they're going out, charging up a couple $100 at the bars downtown. And it's like, what are you doing?
No, I couldn't agree more. And it's so funny that we're talking about this, because one of my favorite movies, which is like the ultimate dude movie of all time, is They Live with Rowdy Roddy Piper. And it's like the greatest line of all time in any movies. I've come to chew bubblegum and kick ass, and I am all out of bubblegum. I love that line. But it's like, it's the idea of the movie is this, that our world is being overrun by these super capitalist reptilian looking aliens, and they're, you know, it's a great movie. It's, oh my God, it's a great movie. I mean, I'm sure if there's any guy that's in our chat room right now, which I'm not in the chat room, they're like, yes, that movie's awesome. But the only way that you can see them and see like their bizarre print media is through these sunglasses. And you know,
oh my gosh, I think I saw that movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's great.
Okay,
I mean,
Yeah,
it looks like they're reading a newspaper, but actually all it says, the only words on it are say, bye, 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 bye. So I think that movie is definitely like an indictment on our American advertising. But if you haven't seen it, it's great.
I want to see it. It sounds awesome.
It's a really great movie. But yeah, we definitely see that. I can see that. I mean, my kid runs... He's 2 years old. He runs directly to the television as soon as like some kind of Disney thing comes on. And I think Disney is just the devil.
So do you have kids?
I have 2 kids, and you're talking about Disney. When I was writing the book, I put Disney's brand of, because they don't want, they're a little bit older. They're teenagers now. And
yeah, mine are too. Mm-hmm.
And that whole Disney phase was, you know, not that long ago. And
oh God, no!
That is advertising genius at its best.
Yes.
Like, here's the movie that promotes the CD, that promotes the spinoff TV show, that promotes the magazine. So, I mean, it goes on and on.
Evil and genius. The reason I was asking you about kids is because Rick's son is just 2, and so he may not have experienced this yet, but I know that your kids are, my son is 16 and my stepson is 14, so mine are teenagers as well. Do you remember the days when you used to dread going to the frickin' cereal aisle?
No, he's already there.
In the grocery store? Oh my God, grocery shopping when my son was, you know, about 4 to 6. Was maybe 3 to 6, especially the cereal aisle, was a nightmare because they put everything eye level for those kids.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And,
God.
And I never noticed
it. Can I have this? Why can't I have this? Oh, my God.
Or by the cash register, there's all those little shit toys that end up in... Oh, I'm sorry.
It's fine.
That's okay. Karen's done an F-bomb before, so you're all
right. I did. I dropped an F-bomb on the air once. And we've had Zach Bagans on, and he regularly drops F-bombs when he's on our show, so, you know.
Okay, sorry. I forget.
No, that's all right. So anyway, you're by the shit toys in the checkout aisle.
they're like at the very bottom rung where there's no way you would ever see them, but your no. you know 1 year old who's you know crawling around sees them, and they're going to end up in the garbage. I mean, they're only a dollar or two, and part of you wants to just buy it so that your kid shuts up.
Yeah, but it's a shut up toy. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yep.
That's how you get out of the grocery store without the meltdown.
But then you can see, it's like you're not psychic, but you're seeing yourself picking it up off the floor and throwing it in the garbage within 2 days, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. But see, that's just it. So so your main character being in advertising suddenly makes a lot more sense to me. All right. So we were talking about the book. So go on. I'm sorry I interrupted you and we got off on a tangent.
Oh, no. He's in charge of the advertising agency, and he's a follower. And a lot of people don't realize this, but right in the Bible, there's this big passage in Revelation that talks about Satan's fall. And people will argue about the exact day that he fell, but most people believe it was before man was created. And it says right in the Bible that he didn't fall alone. He did not take on God single-handedly by himself. He convinced a third of all of the angels to take on God. I mean, whether you're religious or not, this has always stayed with me because it's such a ballsy move, and he somehow, you know, it was kind of like a political coup d'etat, you know, and
God.
Right, and my contention is, well, he gets all of the credit for this, you know, war, but, you know, like Hitler wasn't alone in World War II. He had plenty of monsters helping him. Well, the same with Satan. And instead of, you know, so many writers have had Satan as the bad guy or whatever, my bad guy is, yes, he's a general for Satan, and he's currently Satan's favorite because he can damn the most souls with his advertising. It's like the modern way of getting people to hell. But part of him is kind of like Satan was with God, thinking that he's too big for himself. Well, part of my character, whose name is Armaros, is starting to think that he's too good for Satan. So
there's a little hubris in your protagonist, is what you're saying.
There's a little humor. There's a lot of gore. There's some rules that are established that I'm getting from the Bible and other ancient writings about angels mating with humans. And a lot of people seem to think that angels are these little fat baby cherubs like on Valentine's Day. And that there's like,
you mean they're not?
There's seven different kind, and the archangels, the highest level, are all men. So a lot of them mated with women, and they produced, and this is all in, I'm not making this up, this is all in scriptures and ancient writings, they produced these half-breeds of half-human, half-angel, and they're called Nephilim. And my character is, you know, he latched on to this real religion. It's called the Yazidi religion, and they worship angels. They're in northern Iraq, and they're one of the oldest religions in the world, and he latched on to this religion, and they love him because he appears to them, and they're pushing women at him to mate with, and he's fathering kids, and it goes from there. And most of his kids are screwed up, and they don't know what's the matter with them, and they end up killing themselves, but of course there's a character that doesn't, and it goes from there. And it's gotten about 45 reviews, and it's got about a 4.5 average, so it's
great.
Yeah, it's cranking. So there's the sequel comes out on May 1st, and that's called Halo of the Nephilim.
Cool.
So are these primarily Christian books. You can go to like a Christian bookstore and find these.
Oh no, they're I mean, there's, of course, I used the Bible and ancient writings, but, and I am a Christian, but no, these are horror books. There's they're R-rated and
well, Christians looking, like R-rated things in horror, so it's all right. But no, what you're saying is they're not the Left Behind series or something.
Oh my god. No, it's kind of like if you like Rosemary's Baby or The Omen or Devil's Advocate.
So we should be listening to the music from The Omen. The name of it escapes me right now. Isn't that funny? Dun, 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 dun.
That was a creepy soundtrack.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, that's actually O Fortuna. It's a pretty, from Carmina Burana. It's from an opera. But yeah, that's a great piece of music for The Omen, absolutely.
Dominoes.
Yeah, they got the choir in the background. And
that's music. Right. Yeah. So be paranoid, be prepared.
Oh, now that's just a short story, and it's based on the main character of my first book, The Last Degree.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So is it a conspiracy theory story, too?
Oh, yeah. The Last Degree is, if you like conspiracy theory and you like Dan Brown and you think New World Order is on the rise and, you know, everything that happens in the news, you can somehow link it to, well, that's New World Order. You'd love it. You'd love that book.
I don't even know what the New World Order is. How scary is that?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. You guys are so not alone. New World Order is, a lot of people don't know about it, but it's a conspiracy theory that believes an inner circle of people are running things in this world. And
oh, like the Illuminati.
Right. Illuminati, Freemasons. And no matter who we elect or the wars that we get involved in, it's all orchestrated by this handful of people, and there really is no such thing as democracy, and the whole goal of the inner circle is to get rid of all borders and boundaries and create a one-world government, and then keep the people that benefit them and get rid of the ones that don't. And
Hold on one second. I mean, to me, okay, and I'm sure you're probably going to disagree with this, but I mean, I am all about learning about different cultures and, you know, respecting people for their differences and very accepting, although I wasn't brought up that way, definitely not. But I do believe that. And I for me to say that there's no borders, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
I mean, that's how they're, but again, if you believe in New World Order, that's how they're getting away with it. You know, old peace on that, you know, that John Lennon song.
Are you saying that they're preying on suckers like me and Rick?
Well, that's how they're going to go about it. I'm not saying you guys are suckers, but that's...
Oh, no, I'm the first to admit I'm a total gullible sucker. It's okay.
That's New World Order. And then, of course, there's going to be a leader who, in the name of peace, it's all going to be in the name of peace, in the name of unity, all of that, all those key phrases to get people, get the masses to go along with all of this. Now, some people, like Jesse Ventura types, I don't know if you guys watch his show or you know that much about him, but he's that wrestler governor from Minnesota who, was a Navy SEAL, and he thinks he was in Vietnam, and he thinks the government's, you know, out to screw us over and all, you know. He of course believes in the New World Order, and then if you watch Doomsday Preppers on TV, where you've got people selling off their houses, building underground bunkers, they believe in New World Order. And then you've got this segment of Christians, because it does say in the Bible that in the end of times there will be
come.
Right. There will be no boundaries or borders, and then the leader of the new world will be the Antichrist. So you've got different groups of people who have different reasons that think that this is going to come about. And the book is all about who the they is and how they're going to do it, and you know, who it's all how it could play out.
Okay, so it's a combination of research and from your imagination.
Yes. It's definitely, and I had a lot of fun with it because a lot of the subplots are based on conspiracy theory. So if you're a real conspiracy junkie, you'd be like, wait, I know that one. That's you know, Jack the Ripper. That's oh, I know that one. That's you know, Bush and 9/11. Or oh, I know that one. That's Obama.
Oh, sure.
And, oh,
sure.
It's fun for someone who's a conspiracy theorist to read, and people who don't know anything about it have also really liked it. They thought it was an enjoyable story.
So when you say that you're a conspiracy theory nut, tell me what that means. Does that mean you have an interest in them? Does it mean that you believe them? Does it mean you believe a certain percentage of them?
Well, I totally believe that New World Order is about to hit. And, I mean, as you guys watch in the news, this whole Pope thing, that's total conspiracy theory. Benedict who just stepped down today, he's the last pope before the Antichrist's false prophet takes over the Catholic Church, if you go by the prophecy of Malachi. And I don't know if you're following all this, but
a little bit.
Oh yeah,
I just wondered if they hit him on the head with a silver hammer to make sure he wasn't alive when he stepped down, because that's what they usually do with popes, because they die.
Oh,
never mind.
I thought he looked like the Emperor from Star Wars. So yeah.
That's a total conspiracy theory. That whole thing is weird.
The thing with the Pope stepping down?
Yeah.
Well, so I'm not Catholic, and I know that, I mean, has a Pope ever stepped down before?
I think they said 500 years was the last time it happened.
Huh. Yeah, you know, I mean, me personally, I think that the guy is folding under the pressure because of all of the, you know, the sex abuse stuff that has been going on for the last 12 years. It's been coming out. I think that he's old and he probably can't handle that kind of pressure and that kind of stress.
That's true. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's the main reason why he's doing it.
Sure.
If the New World Order is at hand, what's the time frame that we're looking at? And is it in your lifetime or your kids' lifetime? Or what's the time frame? And if it is in our lifetime or our kids' lifetime, how do you then go about still being just a peaceful, happy person as you go about your days if you believe that this is what's happening?
Well, that's a great question. Obviously, nobody knows the day or the hour, but, you know, like, for instance, this whole Pope thing, the next Pope is supposed to be the false prophet from the Bible who aids the Antichrist in taking over the world. Well, Nostradamus, who's wasn't religious, also had plenty of prophecies that somehow connect with the Bible. And this Malachi Pope, the one that predicted the last 1,000 years of popes. I mean, picture 1,000 years of popes he has predicted with 100% accuracy. And when I say he predicts them, he'll say, oh, well, this pope will be the flower. And then that pope, like, had a crust of a fleur-de-lis on his, you know, his pope mantle. Or, you know what there's Pope John. This pope will be born of the eclipse and will be buried of the eclipse. Well, Pope John II was born during an eclipse, and he was buried during. So he left all of these little clues for each pope. And now this last one, who's supposed to be, I don't know who would want to be the pope after this. This last one, Nostradamus, said the black man in red, which would be a cardinal who is black. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think, well, the Catholics have, you know, really brought on board a lot of people in Africa. And there's a cardinal in Ghana who's very well-liked in Rome, and he studied in Rome, and he's black, and he's a cardinal, and he fits Nostradamus' prophecy, and he fits this Malachi's prophecy. So
are you heading for the hills, if that's the case?
If he gets it in, it's like, oh, my gosh. Where's my underground bonker? Serious. it's too much. And just there's just so many things lining up. I mean, Israel becoming a nation kind of kicked the whole thing off. And exciting time period. Again, I obviously don't know the day or the hour, but a lot of people seem to think that the Antichrist will come from America or England.
Oh, well, I mean, he'll like either surfing or high tea. I don't know which.
Okay.
Now, I'm sorry. Okay. So then, but isn't it sort of like an okay thing? I mean, we finally have our first African-American president. Finally. Okay, it's happened. Now we're going to have our possibility of having the first black pope. I mean, do you think that there is a way, and I'm not saying you, Dina, please do not think that I am saying this about you. Not for a second. But do you think that some of these conspiracies may be racially motivated?
Well, no, because the guy who prophesied about it 1,000 years ago did not mention the person's race. He said his name would be Peter the Roman, though, and this guy in Ghana took the name Peter, and he studied in Rome.
Okay.
It's where the black comes from is from Nostradamus. Nostradamus, in whatever the 1600s, pinpoints. And he wasn't being racial about it at all. He's just saying the black man in red. And you can take that to mean whatever you want, but scholars believe when you're saying a man is in red, no matter what race or creed or whatever, they're mm-hmm. talking cardinal. You're talking the church.
Okay.
Sure. Sure.
Well, yeah.
Well, I just don't think that the world should, you know, come to an end and the men in power should take over before there's a lady pope and a lady president. That's how I feel.
Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be nice?
To see equal representation of people with lady parts? I think so, yes.
Mm-hmm. I do. I mean, I'm glad, you know, we've got Obama being the first, but I think a black woman would have actually been better.
Hey, we could have. Right. Well, I just think that, yeah, I'd like to see a lady pope and a lady. I know there's never going to be a lady pope. I that's sort of joking.
Well, there was about 500 years ago.
There was a lady pope.
There was allegedly a female pope. Yes. But she has been stricken from the record because, well, she was a female and it was medieval Europe and they didn't really, that kind of thing was kind of frowned upon. But check it out. No, seriously, Google Pope Joan. It's a really interesting story.
I will have to, but then, you know, that's, if we get, we don't have enough time. We only have a few more minutes left with this segment. And, you know, that's going to get me into the Gospel of Mary Magdalene and all sorts of other stuff that, you know,
sure.
We just don't have time for me to go there. Yeah. So this has been a really quick segment. So I wanted to, before we signed off, have you tell people where they can buy your books, where they can locate information about you, all of that good stuff.
Well, my website is dinaray.co, not .com. I can't stress that enough because then you won't find me. It's dinaray.co, D-I-N-A-R-A-E. .co. And if you go on there, I'm having a raffle contest right now that, and I've got all kinds of really fun prizes for Halo of the Damned. I'm going to do it in May, too, for the sequel. And it's easy stuff for entry. It's free. I'm not going to email you with spam, none of that, okay? Some of this stuff is like, follow me on Twitter for an entry, or like my Facebook page. Like, easy, free stuff. And no, I'm not into spamming anybody. Okay. Please take advantage. It's got some great prizes. It's all peacock themed.
Yes, and it's then, all very pretty. I'm looking at it right now.
Oh, thank you.
I'm thinking of how I can win it all.
Please. Easy entry. you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Halo of the Damned. You can find me on Pinterest, Dina Ray Books. You can find me on Facebook, Dina Ray Books. You can friend me on Facebook. I follow back. I friend back. You can easily hunt me down on the social media.
What you're saying.
Yeah.
I'm very accessible. I'm not, and I'm very anti spam. I can't stress that enough. I write a blog, and I don't even put that subscriber thing up.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I hate spam. As a matter of fact, I just lately have been cleaning out doing all my unsubscribes because, as you go along, you just sort of collect all these emails, and then one day you realize that your inbox is full of spam and you have to. So I've been in the process of getting unsubscribing to a bunch of stuff. So I appreciate you being anti-spam. So it's dinaray.co, and they can find information about your books there and where to order them as well, correct?
Yeah, they're all on Amazon. Some are on Barnes & Noble and Books A Million and iTunes. But all of them are definitely on Amazon. And most of them are on the other ones, too.
Very good.
Fantastic.
Okay, so Dina, thank you so much for coming on to the show. And good luck with all of your writing. And I hope you are absolutely wrong.
Me too.
I'll be too. Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Have a good evening.
You too.
Good night. Okay, everybody. So stick around. In our next segment, we are going to be talking some time travel, which is really cool.
Yep. Can't wait.
So stick around. It's Paranormal Underground Radio on Z-Talk Radio. We will be right back.
Join us for the largest Paracon in the Northeast as Phantom Light, the night vision experts, along with Glory Haunt Hounds and Beyond Ghost present Preserving the Haunt, Para History Con. April 26th and 27th at the haunted Fort William Henry Resort and Conference Center. Celebrity guests include John Zaffis, Adam Berry, John Kenny, Joe Chin, Reverend Tim Shaw, Brian Kano, Aaron Sagers, Chris DeCesare, Deftone Picture Studios, Tri-City Paranormal of Virginia, Cassie Ray, The Ghost Detectives, Paranormal Expeditions, Daniel Hooven, Phantom Light, Chris Gibbons, John Tobin, John Partito, and more. Ghost Hunt. Lectures, movie screenings of Please Talk With Me, and Shattered Hopes, the true story of the Amityville murders, VIP party, and much, much more. For tickets and more information, go to www.gloryhaunthounds.com or facebook.com/para-historycon.
You're listening to Z-Talk Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Paranormal Underground Radio at ztalkradio.com. We are your hosts, Karen and Rick. For the first 45 minutes or so, we were speaking to author Dina Ray and having a rather, well, very interesting conversation. And those interesting conversations tonight do not end with just Dina. Right now joining us is Andrew Basiago. He is the team leader of the Pegasus Project, and we're going to be talking about something incredibly sci-fi and something that scientists say is not possible, time travel. So, Andrew, welcome to the underground.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you for having me. Just as a point of personal courtesy, my surname is pronounced Bashago, like Chicago.
I'm sorry.
Wondered. Bashago. We should have asked you that in the break. Sorry about that.
Not to cut you off on that, but also I just would like to distinguish the fact that epistemologically, we're not going to be talking about science fiction tonight. That's a bias. We're going to be talking about science fact from 40 years ago, which was the fact that, I mean, that's essentially the meaning of my story. It's the significance of my account, which is that that time travel, different forms of time travel technology emerged in the U.S. defense technical community over 40 years ago, and that science fiction is treated as being from the realm of science fiction when, in fact, it's science fact and has been for many decades since we were children.
Well, I didn't mean any offense by it. I just meant that that's, you know, how people would view it. But I mean, but that's why you're here on the show tonight, is to, you know, to clear that up.
Right. I just wanted to emphasize that so that your listeners knew that's the context in which we're exploring the information, is that time travel has been treated as science fiction, and science fiction has been used as a literary genre to confuse the public about technologies that have already emerged secretly, that the U.S. and other major governments would seek to conceal.
Of course.
So this is just the thought of what you're saying, which is, look, this isn't fiction, this is a fact, is very mind-blowing to me in one way, but in another way, it makes perfect sense. Rick's going to hate it that I even bring this up, but I'm a big quantum physics geek. And so I believe that many things are very possible, and even probable, but I didn't realize that we were there yet. So can you talk about Project Pegasus? And you were involved in Project Pegasus as a child. Is that correct?
That's correct. From 1967-68, when I first teleported as a six-year-old, until 1972, when I last was involved in the very advanced time travel technologies that had emerged during those 5 years. And then I had an ordinary junior high school and first year of college period as an adolescent, and I was brought back into U.S. government operations in the summer of 1980, in the CIA's Mars Jump Room program. So we're really talking about two periods of my life when I had some extraordinary experiences that I'm now sharing with the American people.
So how does a six-year-old child be the one that's selected to participate in that? Because six is so young. I mean, was there something about you that made you the right kind of, I don't know, physiological build, or what is it about you that you were the person that did this at such a young age?
Well, that one-off jump as a six-year-old before being officially placed in the program in the fall of 1969 as a third grader, basically age seven going on age eight, my initial jump was in the company of my late father, Raymond F. Bashago, who was an electrical engineer for the Ralph M. Parsons Company. And my dad was essentially the dollar-a-year man. He was the chief technical liaison between Parsons and the CIA on teleportation. And that first jump resulted when my dad brought me up to the old Curtis Wright Aeronautical Company facility in New Jersey to jump to Santa Fe to then drive into a meeting with Dr. Harold M. Agnew when he was the director of the weapons division at the labs. And my dad took with him on that trip a prospectus to urge the labs to begin testing teleportation on both adults and children, because my dad was devoted to the idea that teleportation was such a valuable technology that it shouldn't remain secret within the defense technical realm.
So teleportation, okay. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to get this clear. Teleportation, we're not talking traveling through time, merely traveling through space like you would see on Star Trek. Is that correct?
No. Well, the first question is half correct and the second is incorrect. Essentially, during that jump and early jumps that I took, and throughout the program, I took real-time jumps back and forth across the country.
Mm-hmm.
But by the fall of 1970, the device could be set 12 hours back in time, and that time envelope increased not only as the time envelope in which teleportation had existed widened as a result of the passage of time, but as they became able to displace us with the Tesla device forward and backward in time. And they also began introducing other technologies that allowed, for example, to travel to the recent, medieval, and ancient, even the primordial past, via different kinds of devices.
Okay.
The second part of your question, I've lost my train of thought here, what your second point was. Star Trek.
Yeah.
The second point is that, in fact, the Tesla teleporters were doing the opposite of the form of teleportation that was depicted on Star Trek, which literally debuted on American television in 1966, right around the time our atomic research community reduced Tesla teleportation to practice, which had to have been that 1966-67 period, because my father asked Harold Agnew whether he had tried the experience yet, and he said, no, but I want to, meaning that the reduction to practice of Tesla teleportation was pretty much a new feat within the Fed's technical community. Actually, it does the opposite of what was depicted on Star Trek. It opens up a tunnel in time space that you pass through. It doesn't digitize somebody or disintegrate somebody physically and reassemble them at the destination, because they knew and they had experimented with the fact that that will kill a living organism, including...
Right.
Yeah.
So, well, and that's what I understand, because when you read about now they talk about, because clearly it's you're right that there is absolutely no transparency as far as this technology being available, because when you read about teleportation as being possible, they talk about quantum teleportation where they destroy very, very, very small particles and then rebuild them in a different place. And so this is not doing that. This is doing something completely different.
Correct. What happened is Bortle teleportation emerged secretly in the U.S. defense technical community based on Tesla's papers, which had been forwarded to the Los Alamos physics community at the time of its emergence when they were building the atomic bomb there in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
They remained weaponized as a result, because from the perspective of the Defense Department and the CIA, at least primarily the Defense Department, but even people attached to CIA as well, who you would expect to be maybe a little bit more thoughtful, you know, jarheads in the Pentagon.
Sure.
They viewed it simply as a weapon that would enable us to put troops precisely where they were needed on the battlefield. And so, essentially, when Vortal teleportation emerged, it was weaponized and it remained secret. So when very well-produced TV shows and movies about time travel were introduced around that time, such as Star Trek, the emphasis was on quantum teleportation.
Yes.
We see still in today's science fiction that's the alternate meme that they keep on reinforcing, even in the legitimate science press, four decades after a different form of teleportation emerged. So that's how science fiction has been used. They basically frame a concept and then give you a denatured version of the opposite of the truth of a specific technology.
Now, okay, you said that it's opening a tunnel through space-time. I seem to remember a television show. I'm only 39 years old, so this was definitely before my time, but I'm kind of a nerd, so I like science fiction.
Right.
I seem to remember a show called Time Tunnel, where these two cats, they get in and they step in and, you know, takes them around, and it's all like, you know, it's a very 60s kind of a television show. The device that does this, what kind of power does it take to send a person 1,000 miles away or 1,000 years into the past?
Well, displacement in time takes a larger teleporter, and for that they needed the Stargate devices, which were much larger, had much higher energy inputs, and caused the teleportee to remain in the Vortal tunnel for, let's say, 30 seconds rather than 3 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
The relevance of Irwin Allen's time travel, which emerged on ABC television right around the time that Star Trek was, and that we had already begun sending people through time-space via Vortal tunnels propagated by Vortal teleporters based on latter works of Nikola Tesla, is another example of one of these science fiction shows where, okay, Star Trek gave you the opposite. It gave disintegrating the teleportee at embarkation and reintegrating them at destination.
Okay.
Then, because a tunnel was being used, the Time Tunnel TV show gave us a concretized form of the tunnel, when in fact the Tesla teleporter worked by having the teleportee jump through a field of radiant energy, and their inertia opened up a pocket in time-space
that
resembled a tunnel as they were moving forward. And you went through time rather than being disintegrated and going through time in a more of a normal way, the way, let's say, an automobile sweeps you. There they were confusing the public with the notion that time tunnels existed. So they concretized the tunnel when, in fact, it's a process that takes place at a higher state of being. So while the teleportee sees a tunnel around him or her, people who might sense or be able to try to perceive whether time travel is occurring cannot see the tunnel because it's occurring essentially through the quantum plenum. It's occurring as a null field, literally through the interstices of time and space itself.
Well, it changes how we think about time, with this being something that's not just possible, but that's happened then. Because we view, I think that the general view of time is that it's not something that you can travel any direction through except for forward and only at a very limited rate, where, you know, you can go backwards and forwards in every other dimension, but our view is that that's not the case in time. So obviously you must be able to, and that time is just like any other dimension. Is that correct?
That's correct. There's a fundamental public misunderstanding that spans the gamut from our own perceptions that we develop from the time that we're born into being able to state it in a distilled way by referring to the laws of physics. And here it is. If you look at the second law of thermodynamics, that principle of physics states that the universe seeks entropy. Entropy is the tendency of everything to fall away, both matter and energy.
Yes.
So when something occurs, we sense, even as children, that it exists in the past as a mental concept, but that absent time travel, we can't access the past. So let me just give an example, let's say, from childhood. When we're children, we're playing around with cap guns. We fire the gun, and we hear it, the noise it makes, and we smell the gunpowder. But 5 minutes ago when we did that, that event is past. It's gone. We can't perceive it. Okay, now that's that notion of reality, of things occurring and then being invisible because they don't exist anymore. I mean, the gunpowder explodes. If we could take a microscope and film, let's say an electron microscope, and film what was going on, we would see the Mandelbrot functions of all the little turtles or whatever, however the gunpowder has formed, branching off and getting smaller and smaller and basically evanescing in basically the null field as a past event that no longer exists anymore. That view of reality is encoded in the second law of thermodynamics, in the sense that, I mean, the implication is that the past can't exist because it was destroyed in its moment of creation. The present can be perceived, the past can be remembered, and the future can be anticipated, but that's what contemporary physics and the Newtonian and even Einsteinian principles of physics tell us when we try to distill our own conceptions of reality as we study physics in high school and college.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case. Essentially, what explains the framing of the second law of thermodynamics is our perceptions. In fact, the past, present, and future exist simultaneously. And if we can move the percipient to perceive the past and future, that past event can be experienced originally. In other words, the conceit that the second law of thermodynamics was of general applicability is what the reality of time travel defeated. And even when Project Pegasus was ongoing and we were time traveling, individuals like Enrico Fermi, the great Italian physicist, were saying, we cannot invent a device to visit the past because the past doesn't exist as anything more than an idea. And what he was asserting, and Bernard Mendez, my colleague from the Jump Room program, has appeared with me a number of times to articulate Fermi's position. Fermi was saying that these trips to past events must be to some solid state environment in the universe where the past is stored, just like we store a movie on a DVD. Or on Star Trek, they store an event on a holodeck. In other words, Fermi was trying to reconcile the second law of thermodynamics with people's accounts that they were going back in time and experiencing an original event. Now, I know that Fermi was wrong because, for example, in the spring of 1972, I was sent to Gettysburg via one of the time travel technologies that Project Pegasus developed, and I was photographed there at the original event. So if I had just been in the so-called Josephine Cobb image of Lincoln at Gettysburg, I hope someday it'll be known as the first photograph to show a time traveler from the future, myself.
Right.
But it was the original event, and the evidence is in the photograph. I'm in the photograph of the original event, and so is President Lincoln. And so if I had just been visiting some holographic holodeck stored in some...
You wouldn't be there.
Some corner of the universe where either a higher intelligence or God or the universe itself is recording what happens, I would not have been in that photograph of the original event.
Okay, so I want to back up for just a sec, sorry, Rick, because I'm still trying to just totally grasp the concept. So what you're saying about how time exists is that everything, every moment that has ever occurred or ever will occur or is occurring in the universe exists right now. This moment is all there is, and all we have to do is move through those moments. Is that correct?
On the macro universal level, or you could say the macro multiversal level, yes. Mm-hmm. Everything is in what should be conceptualized or can be conceptualized as the time-space continuum. What exists in a moment is what we perceive in a moment. And so the framing of the second law of thermodynamics was dependent on the orientation that we have as intelligent organisms to the time-space continuum at the micro multiversal level, our immediate environment. But there's a broader reality consisting of the entire time-space continuum. So if I can be sent physically, as I was, to November 19th of 1863, guess what was going on in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania? Abraham Lincoln was delivering the Gettysburg Address, and I was there when it was originally happening. So we're really talking about two frames of reference. The immediate one that governs what we can perceive right now, where we're locked into the time-space continuum based on the moment of our birth, and then the passage of time that results after our birth. But that's not the larger reality. The larger environment in which events are going on is an environment or a timeline, a time-space continuum, when all past, present, and future event scenarios are going on simultaneously in a larger universe than we can perceive.
And it's funny too, because it's like I've oftentimes, you know, we've had a lot of people on Gettysburg. About my great great grandfather was at Gettysburg. My grandfather actually has a photo of his dad sitting on his lap, wearing his Confederate uniform. But it's very mind blowing. I would love to see this picture because I have seen some pictures, and you know that would make you think that, okay, this is possible, like the Canadian Bridge opening in 1941. There's a guy standing there, and he's wearing what looks like very modern clothes and very modern eyewear, and he's wearing a print shirt. They didn't have that in 1941. He definitely looks way out of place. Or the Charlie Chaplin from the circus, where you see a woman in the background. She passes behind a zebra, and it clearly looks to me like she's talking on a cell phone. And she's looking around like, oh my God, does anybody see me doing this?
Well, so, let me distinguish those two photographs from the one of me at Gettysburg. Cause actually, I've never really addressed this before on radio.
Okay.
And that is, when we look at past data of times we're not familiar with, we don't have all of the data to reach a conclusion that there's anomalous content in the photograph.
Okay.
In the case of the young man at the bridge opening in British Columbia in the 40s, in fact, if we scrutinize his clothing, he's wearing a kind of a grainy jacket and a letter sweater painted in the manner of the 1940s. What actually strikes us in that picture is that must have been a college man who stopped to watch the bridge opening. And basically what he is in the photograph is taller, thinner, more stylishly dressed than the other attendees, and basically younger and more handsome. And so what we see is this GQ guy standing there. But in fact, if we scrutinize the picture more closely and don't apply a presentist examination, you know, a presentist attitude about what is in the photograph, we see that he is wearing period clothing. Okay. So that's a contemporary person for that photograph. In the case of the 1928 clip from the Charlie Chaplin film, we look at a woman, an elderly woman, who's walking about 10 feet in front of a man who is following her at the same pace and at the same gait, who is probably her husband or brother or same-aged friend, and she seems to be saying something while holding something up to her ear. Well, in order to evaluate what's in a time-based photograph, we have to ask what it could be in that time. And I identified no less than 4 handheld hearing aids about the size of a contemporary cell phone that were commercially available in 1928. So if we use Occam's razor and say, which is more likely, the easy answer that she was holding a hearing aid from that era or a cell phone during a time when there weren't Gwen towers to allow for cell phone communication, we have to conclude, and also because she's elderly and more than the majority of hearing loss results from aging and not from having a hearing deficit at birth from a birth defect or an injury, but just simple aging. Because she's an elderly woman, that also supports the conclusion that she's simply holding something from that time up against her ear. But let me now distinguish that kind of analysis, where I believe both of those are contemporary people and not time travelers, with my subjective claim that I'm a time traveler in the Gettysburg photograph that was discovered in 1951 to have several pixels in the back literally depicting the head of Abraham Lincoln as he was sitting down. Mm-hmm. What I'm attired in that photograph are grossly oversized men's civilian shoes. So in any era, a boy who seems to be 9 or 10 years old, based on height and his features and so forth, and comparing his physiology to the physiology of surrounding adults, is almost never going to have shoes that are grossly oversized, because for one thing, you can't walk very easily in inappropriate footwear. It's difficult to walk, for example, in shoes that are grossly oversized for your feet. And there I am. Other people have noted that I'm heavier than the people in that starving, rural, Civil War Pennsylvania setting, that I'm standing in a very relaxed sort of 1970s pose right off of a, you know, Jim Morrison standing on a, in a photograph on a Doors album, and that there's something both nonchalant and intentionally anomalous or distracting about my posture. In fact, I was assuming a posture of great relaxation and looking literally with my back to the dais, looking in the opposite direction that I knew that Lincoln would soon be arriving, because I had been pestered by several different authorities up near the dais and had even encountered my father there, who had gone there during a different year in real time, and yet we had that encounter. So he looked younger to me than he looked back at the time travel lab in East Hanover, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And I looked older to him than I had looked at the lab and, you know, earlier that morning at our house in Morris Plains, New Jersey. Okay, so if you look at multiple elements, I'm also, for example, in both civilian shoes and military issue. I'm in a blue Union winter parka, and I'm wearing the distinctive pantaloon pants of a Union bugle boy, dark, you know, blue pantaloon pants, but I'm in grossly oversized brown men's street shoes. I don't know if you can see the brown.
Those are some big shoes.
Yeah, those are rather large.
They've been estimated at size 14. They were huge when the man who helped me took them off the shelf at the back of a millinery shop in downtown Gettysburg to shod my feet, because I walked into Gettysburg from about 40 minutes on foot north of town with my teeth chattering literally uncontrollably from the brisk November air. Okay, so in that photograph, you can say, well, wait a minute. Andy's making the subjective allegation that he's that child, which means he would have had to travel time travel 109 years to get there. Well, what's literally attached to him that helps establish that? And one of the things is, there I am 4 months after Gettysburg, long after the bodies would have been buried and carpetbaggers would have removed clothing from the battlefield and so forth. The battle was from July 1st to 4th of 1863. Here it is, November 19th. Mm-hmm. I'm wearing this hodgepodge of clothing, which may have put my life at risk. If I was presumed to be a child carpetbagger, I may have been shot or hanged for being a carpetbagger. I had drawn attention to myself from both a small group of women and several Union officers up near the stage. And here I am, 100 paces from where Lincoln now is sitting down, in this hodgepodge of clothes, including shoes that would still be 4 sizes too big for me as an adult. I wear a size 10 and a half. These were like 14, 15 size. Okay. I actually shuffled to that site from the millinery shop because I could not walk in those shoes. Now, that's anomaly. I'm not saying it proves it to a dispositive certainty, but that's photographic anomaly, because that kind of inappropriate footwear would be anomalous on a child wherever we would find a picture of any human child. Adults do not shod the feet of children in shoes that would give them permanent injury, permanent disability. So that's what we have to look for when we're trying to say that person in this vintage photograph is a time traveler or maybe a time traveler. Another example, just to be fair about my claims, is that Dr. Bruce Goldberg is an authority both on reincarnation and on time travel. And he developed a case in which somebody who had wanted to visit the Grand Canyon from the Midwest in the 1940s ended up going there in the 1960s or 70s. But when they developed their photographs, the automobiles that were captured in the photographs were vintage 1940 automobiles. As if the person's desire to visit the Grand Canyon had finally manifested 30 years later. So that was apparently a form of time travel that occurred in that situation. So we have to look at what's anomalous in the elements in the photograph, not just say, well, somebody looks kind of out of place, or they wouldn't have had this modern technology then. Well, yes, they wouldn't have had cell phones because there weren't any Gwen Towers to boost the signals, but they did have handheld hearing aids, and that's what I think the woman is holding.
Okay. So now, but you had a situation where you actually ran into yourself, correct?
Correct. When we send the same person to the same location in time space at different times, they meet themselves. And there's virtually no offset in age if you do so very quickly, because your age is going to be the age back on your alpha timeline, your real-time timeline.
Right. Okay.
You can also, if you, as an elderly person, if you visit yourself as a child or vice versa, you're going to notice the difference in age. So that kind of farcical Swedish commercial where the guy goes under a sink and he meets an elderly version of himself, and they're both bald, and they take the pose at the end of the commercial, you know, where the younger has his arm around the older, and it's a, you know, a 40-year older version of himself. Mm-hmm. That can happen when you send an elderly or a young person in the opposite direction. You'll encounter a much younger or much older version of yourself. But the way I encountered myself, we didn't speak, but I saw myself twice, is that in the summer of 1971, they sent me 5 or 6 times to the Lincoln assassination site at Ford's Theater in Washington on April 14th of 1865. But because, and that was via the time travel device called a chronovisor, which propagates a hologram, a moving hologram, mm-hmm. of usually a past, but sometimes a future event, where if you're standing in the hologram when it envelops you, you automatically, you know, spontaneously go to that time and place that's being identified in the time-space continuum and amplified by the chronovisor. And so in the summer of 1971 in New Mexico, I was sent to that location 5 or 6 times, and on one of the initial jumps, I looked over to my right as I was walking through a hallway, and I thought I was viewing an image of myself in a lengthy mirror. But then the image on my right veered to the right and off the wall, and I realized myself at a different time that I'd been sent there. And then I did several more jumps, and I didn't run into myself. But then I experienced the same thing looking at myself on the left, and I did the veering.
Oh. Okay.
Wow.
So you experienced it from both perspectives of you.
And this is a cardinal principle of time travel that we should refer to when we disabuse anybody, particularly a troubled person, about the prospect of going to the past to correct some tragic or unfortunate outcome. When we are sent to the past, and if we're sent to the place where we were at a particular time, tragically or sadly for those who would want to correct the past, we don't become ourselves, we encounter ourselves. And then a corollary to that is, if you didn't encounter yourself in the past, in the future you're not going to time travel to meet yourself, because your past experience of not encountering yourself is already your experience. It's already condign evidence that you won't be visiting yourself from the future.
Oh, so if I have not actually, you know, like met myself under the sink or something, that's because I never did it?
I think everybody in the time travel field, including a technologist like, let's say, Dr. David Anderson, a time travel experiencer like myself, or somebody who bridges theory and practice like Amishio Kaku, we get letters and emails virtually every week. I mean, I get a couple a week from some very well-intended person who asks me, you know, how can I get into this federal time travel project? And I say, well, it was 40 years ago, so if we could find a teleporter, now we could teleport you back to the project, or find where the technology is now. But they say, no, seriously, you know, I lost my wife in a car accident, or my son was killed in an airplane crash, and can I go back and warn them not to go on that trip and save their life? And I say, well, you could go back and encounter them. If you went back to encounter yourself, to tell yourself to do that, if you would have to find them in the past, the tragedy is you don't become yourself. You would have to visit yourself, or you would have to visit them to tell them
right.
Directly. And if you didn't do that, if you didn't experience yourself giving yourself this advisement from the future, or if they didn't meet with you, or if they didn't meet with you, if they didn't believe you, you can't reverse or change a past event. You can only fulfill it. But the difficulty of going back in the past to fulfill an event is that if it's a tragic event and you did go back and give somebody a prudent advisement, let's say you stayed long enough to know they were at risk from something, you're not going to know about it in the future if you prevented it.
Right.
Okay,
so we have to disabuse people of this notion that the past can't be changed. It can only be fulfilled. Now, why is that? Because when you intervene in a past event from the future, you're there in what I call the past's present. I didn't go back to Gettysburg to create a second timeline like the mistaken parable of Schrodinger's cat suggests. In other words, when I intervened in 1863 from 1972, I went to the original event. I was there in the past's first
right.
event.
Okay.
And I didn't go and change. I didn't go and put myself there. So, for example, when I left 1972 to go to 1863, and by being there, I was photographed in the Josephine Cobb photograph, the photograph already existed in 1972 because I had already visited 1863. I just still
right.
had to do it in real time, retrocausally, to create that cause. But the effects had already manifest because I had already been there in the original November 19th of 1863 in Gettysburg, PA.
So there never was a holy crap kind of moment where you're like, hey, this lady accidentally photographed me?
Well, what never happened, actually, she was the analyst at the Library of Congress. It was probably Matthew Brady or somebody who certainly looked like Brady who got up on a small stepladder and took the photograph. No, what, okay. What it means is when I went back to New Jersey in 1972 when the plasma confinement effect that had sent me there wore off, all of the versions of the Josephine Cobb image everywhere in the world didn't suddenly morph into a version with me in it toward
okay.
the foreground of the image. Indeed, when I left for Gettysburg, I was already in the image because I had been there in 1863. I just had to go there retrocausally to close that loop, that time loop retrocausally. So all of these movies like Loopers and so forth, which posit the notion that when you time travel to the past, you correct it. You have a Groundhog Day where you create a second iteration
right.
of that
okay.
past event scenario on a second timeline. They are not true because look at it just from a perspective of logic. If you're time traveling, that's the essence of time travel. You're going and being inserted, let's say, in a past event. Well, it has to be the original past event or some version of it in another timeline, right?
Right.
One sure. that you're not in until you get there when you have future evidence of your presence there before you leave the present. You see?
Yeah.
Basically, it closes the time loop. It doesn't create a second time loop.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense, actually, yeah. Now that you know, because one of the things that you see in science fiction is that time travel causes all of these paradoxes. And really, it's not. You're just going and being there. But it makes me wonder about things like predestination and free choice. If you traveled to something and affected the past, was that something that was always going to happen? Did you have a choice in it? Did you affect the past because you traveled? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, that's one of the paradoxes that's been explored, and it's invalid. So let me try to...
Okay.
Okay.
It's a superimposition of what was originally the religious notion of predestination, that some people would be saved because God had originally intended it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go back in the past, let's say when I went back to Gettysburg and I decided to move away from where the women and the officers were pestering me, and I had the weird encounter with my dad in front of the dais, center front of the dais, when I made that decision to walk 100 paces away from the dais and put my back to the dais and look 180 degrees from where I knew President Lincoln would soon be arriving on the dais with David Wills, the proprietor of the Wills Hotel, that was a free will decision in a deterministic universe, in a universe that's malleable based on our decisions and our actions. The reason that we confuse that with predestination is when I made that free will decision to move away from the dais, it got fixed in the past like all events get fixed in the past. It became
right.
The event threshold collapsed. We had what physicists call the collapse of the wave function.
Right.
And that event remained in the time-space continuum as a residual signal. But that's not predestination. That's simple. That's just the physics of eventuality, right? Predestination confuses it with that therefore it has to inevitably happen. No, it happened. It's not going to inevitably happen because I did it in 1972 and affected 1863. I made it happen in 1863 based on my free will choice making
right. In
a deterministic quantum hologram, and then it persisted as a past event. That's not predestination.
Right. Well, if time exists all at once, then it isn't. You're absolutely right, because any decision I make now regarding time travel, it's your collapsed wave function is a perfect way to explain it. I get it now. Thank you.
Oh, no, there is. There is a corollary to this line of thinking that actually is a true paradox. And that is, when you contaminate the present with information from the future, you destroy linear causation and you create circular causation. So let me give you an example.
Okay.
Just an example. It's kind of almost like a parable. When I was on Project Pegasus, the project physicists, including Dr. Harold Agnew and my father was an engineer, but the project principals, were collecting books that I would write or edit from the future because they wanted to know why I would become the principal whistleblower of their project.
Okay.
Now, in one lunch setting, they were reading a book I had written in my 40s. Okay. It was an academic text. I don't want to name it, but they were in possession of it.
Okay.
At the front of that book, I had placed... Okay, so they're in the past, in let's say 1971, 72 time frame in New Mexico. They're holding a book, let's just give it an arbitrary publication date of 2007. At the front of that book, I had placed a statement that was a proverb about learning. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
As the book was being passed around, this 2007 tome, one of the project engineers wrote what I had written at the front of the book in the future. He said it out loud in 1971.
You heard it.
I heard it. Okay. Now, if as I matured, I put it in the book because I overheard him saying it in 1971 in real time from an artifact from the future. So when I put it in the book, did I put it in the book because I thought it up and did linear causation and ended up in the book? No. I ended up putting it in the book in adulthood because I had heard him read it from my book when he was in the past. That basically causes linear causation to collapse, and those two events, me putting it in the book and him reading it out loud, begin to circulate around each other as the cause of the event. the event being the publication of that phrase or proverb, you know, that proverbial saying in the front of the book.
Okay.
Because, look, I put it in the book. I put it in the book because I heard it from him as a kid. He read it.
Yeah.
And over him. So what was the cause of the saying?
Me. Chicken egg. Yeah, wow. Just my brain just exploded.
I call that the pretzel in the microwave problem. You know, it's no longer linear. Just as we can bake a pretzel in an oven or a conventional oven or a microwave oven, after the pretzel is twisted into a pretzel, I mean, if it could just be hovering there in time space, you would say, wait a minute, how is this pretzel twisted? We've got a twisted pretzel inside a universe or a local environment that shows no evidence of a pretzel maker. That's what happens when you contaminate the present with information from the future. If somebody acts based on that information, what is the ultimate cause of what happens? So let me give you a more vaunted example. They've been identifying future presidents using quantum access, which is time travel to past and future events, and also propagating these holograms of past and future events and using other time travel devices. What happens when you identify a future president and then in real time put a team in place to keep him or her alive and to groom them, him or her, for the presidency? If you're using information of them becoming president to inform the process of preparing them for the presidency, what causes them to become president? Their own innate yearning and preparation that later creates the future event, or your decision in the present to begin grooming them because you know the outcome that they're destined to be president? Same thing.
Right.
It's basically, I call it also interpolated proto-causation. Just as you can affect a past event retrocausally from the future, you can affect a future event proto-causally from the past. But when you blur the two, you basically convert that linear conception of retrocausation and proto-causation into a circular conception of retro or proto-causation, where both the past and future are causing each other. And that was one of the dangers they were trying to prevent. Because by keeping the information that we were learning, for example, about a certain person's future or the future secret, most of what the project was learning was kept back from somebody like me who was gathering the intelligence data. And I only overheard several conversations where they let slip about something that the future held.
You know, like, hey. Andrew, I got to tell you, I'm going to lay awake tonight staring at the ceiling with my eyes wide open, trying to work my way through all of this. So, unfortunately, 45 minutes was not enough time to talk to you.
No, I had so many questions.
I hope that you will be willing to come back on with us, because okay. I have so many questions. But I wanted to give you just a minute to tell people where they can go find out more information about you, about Project Pegasus, and about all of the things that you're talking about here, because it's just an amazing subject.
Yeah.
Well, I was developing two websites, one projectpegasus.net and the other projectmars.net. I've started to put my time travel and my Mars life discourse and Mars jump room discourse at those websites. I think I'm about 2 years behind at this point, because essentially what happened is Facebook just took off, and yeah. I developed two groups on Facebook that really cabin the ongoing discourse about time travel and life and Mars. And that's Project Pegasus, a group on Facebook that you can join, and the Mars Anomaly Research Society group on Facebook as well. They've been much more creative in terms of, you know, people asking me questions and posting their own information about those topics. But I'm going to go back this year and hopefully write up all my existing papers that still have to be posted on both of those sites. So those sites do contain some material that never got onto Facebook. I also have a profile page on Facebook, Andrew D. Bushago, that can no longer be joined, but people can follow some of the discourse there as well. But the really rich source of the time travel material has become Project Pegasus, which is a group on Facebook.
Okay. Thank you so much. Like I say, I really hope that you'll come back and talk to us, because I have about a bazillion questions after I lay awake for a couple nights trying to figure it out. And I know Rick had a bunch at the outset, I didn't let him ask any of them, because that's just the way I am. So, Andrew Bushago, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's projectpegasus.net.
Yes.
And also Project Pegasus and the Mars Anomaly Research Society on Facebook, and projectmars.net. Did I get them right?
Yeah, that's the website for the Mars Anomaly Research Society, which is a nonprofit corporation here in the state of Washington. And I've got a lot coming in terms of new life forms and ancient artifacts that we found on Mars that my society has found. And I've got more occasional papers on time travel than we'd be posting on projectpegasus.net.
We didn't even get to Mars. No. All right. Thank you so much for coming on. Have a good evening, Andrew.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Karen.
Good night.
Good night.
Oh, my mind is blown.
It's definitely an interesting conversation, and that really is a great picture from the Civil War. And I can't help but thinking that I've seen that picture many times before, and I just don't really know what to think at the moment. I have no reason to believe Andrew, and I have no reason to disbelieve Andrew. So I don't know, Karen, what do you think?
I'm going to lay awake staring at the ceiling this evening.
Okay.
Ripping my covers up under my chin with my eyes wide and my mind whirling. So I was absolutely fascinated, and 45 minutes wasn't enough time to talk to him, but sometimes that happens. So, hey, Rick, I wanted to bring Cheryl on.
Yes.
Because we have an announcement we have to make, and we're going to let Cheryl, our fearless leader, make it for us.
Hi. Thanks, Karen.
Hi.
I'm going to lay awake
before we staring before at we ceiling. Announce. What did you think? Is your brain whirling about 1,000 miles an hour?
It is. I have a million questions for Andrew, and
get him back on.
I got to email him. A million questions, and it's almost like, where do you begin?
2 hours may not be enough.
I kept Skyping Karen and Rick. What about this? What about this?
I know. And people were asking great questions in the chat room, and I was paying attention to them. But here's the thing:
no.
I had my own questions.
I know. It's just it's the topic. It's just mind blowing. It's just like you think of one thing, and then something else comes up, and it was awesome. Good conversation.
Yeah,
and
he's
also
very articulate and very good at explaining it in ways that are not too horribly brain bending, just mind blowing.
Yeah, kind of like Dr. Michio Kaku. I mean, he explains all that stuff so, you know, and dummy like me can understand.
Well, I thank Andrew for coming on. I thank Dina for coming on. I thought that conversation was interesting too. I felt like that we didn't have enough time, but you know, it was
great,
really good.
Great subjects tonight. A lot of fun.
Yeah. So good job. Good job.
Good job to you too. And so we have someone else to thank tonight too, and that's the source of our announcement.
We do. We have
go for it.
We have someone to thank. We must thank our home for the last over two and a half years.
It'll be 3 years in June.
We need to thank our home for the last 2.5 to 3 years, Z-Talk Radio. We need to thank Scotty Rorick for giving us this home and this opportunity to talk.
You all listen to us.
Yeah, we really have appreciated Scotty's hospitality and letting us have a show. This will actually be our last week on the station. We've actually decided to move to another network for a fresh start. We redid the website. We redid the magazine. We just felt it was time for a fresh start. And so we just wanted to give a big thank you to the network, and we wish everybody here a continued success. We have a lot of friends on the network, so
we love the shows. Yeah.
We'll
love
still
the
be
network.
Listening.
Z-Talk has been fantastic, and I'd like to join Cheryl in saying thank you. You took a chance on a little baby show that was a podcast that was pretty rough around the edges, and you know, you've given us the airwaves. You let me stay on the air after my F-bomb. So Scotty, thank you so much.
I
appreciate you, and I appreciate all the shows and the people that we've gotten to know on this network. And we're not leaving the air, but we're going to be on the air next week, as a matter of fact. We have a show next Thursday. But you need to go to paranormalunderground.net. You can find out where we'll be. You can find it on our social media pages after the show. So please stay with us and keep listening to the show and keep listening to the great shows on Z Talk as well.
Definitely. Definitely.
You know, and I just want to, you know, to say that that's not BS. I mean, we really do like the shows on here. I personally love Joe Kudo and Kale Kelly with The Skeptical Edge. I think those guys are great. And congratulations to them for going FM. I think that's really awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Paranormal Hotspot with Jenny and Chris. I mean, it's like, you know, these people, you know, practically everybody that comes into your life has some kind of significance or some kind of importance. And I would definitely say that, you know, Z Talk has given me a voice.
We know
the rest of us. I know, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, it's not BS when we say that we do, you know what, it's not bullshit when we say that we like people, that we love the shows on here and that we love the people. It's not. And we really do mean that. So and thank you for giving us the opportunity to be heard. So thank you, Scotty. Thank you for everybody else who is on this network. Thank you very much.
All right. So with that said, we have Fox City's Paranormal coming up after us. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the chat room, but I don't see. Do you know what they're doing, Cheryl?
I do not.
They do not. All right.
I do not.
And remember also that Paranormal Underground, you can check us out at paranormalunderground.net. You can find all of the great Z Talk shows that we've done over the years in our on demand section. If you go to, I believe it's just the radio tab. Mm-hmm. And we've had some fantastic guests, and we've had a really good time here at Z Talk, and we're looking forward to where we're going in the future too. So, the other people that we have to thank are those of you who listen to us every single week. You're in the chat room with us. You're asking great questions for our guests. You're listening to the show. So thank you to you, our listeners, as well.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, and we just got the update on the next guest on the upcoming show for Fox City's Paranormal is Justin Libiggs.
Okay. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Anything else? Oh, so I'd like to remind everybody, come see me at the Oregon Ghost Conference in Oregon City. You can check it out at Oregon Ghost Conference. Just Google it. I think it's OregonGhostConference.net, but I'm not sure. That's not this coming weekend. It's the following weekend. So I've got that coming up.
Go ahead.
There's a new magazine coming out in the next day or so, right?
Yes, there's a new magazine coming out probably this weekend, possibly Monday. I also wanted to say, I had promoed this before, but we do have the 12-month digital subscription up and running. So if you want a Paranormal Underground magazine to be mailed to you in an email PDF form each month, you can just go to paranormalunderground.net, sign up for a 12-month digital subscription, and it'll automatically be sent to you for the next 12 months. You don't have to worry about finding it or anything like that. And it's 15% off if you do the 12-month digital subscription versus just buying them one at a time. So please do.
All right, so this is it. We're signing off of Z Talk Radio. And again, Z Talk Radio, we love you, and we thank you so much for everything you've done for us. Good luck to all of you, and check us out at paranormalunderground.net. You can also look at us on our social media pages, and we will all be announcing where we will be next week. It'll be the same time. It'll be the same day. It'll just be a new network. So looking forward to talking to you all next week. Everybody have a great weekend, and thank you, Z Talk.
Yes, thank you, Z Talk.
Thank you. See you guys next week.
Okay.
Good night.
Night.
Good night.
If you'd like to be a guest on Paranormal Underground Radio, email editor@paranormalunderground.net. Until next week, keep exploring the unexplained at www.paranormalunderground.net and join us again next week for Paranormal Underground Radio on the Z Talk Radio Network.